I mean, psychologically, it's a little pathetic, right? They think they own these people, and they pretend it's a pretend game.
All right, now we get to the most exciting part of the show.
We need concrete rules here.
I will say this, a couple quick things about him, because I just remembered a random fact. A
usual great analysis there.
You did that without a spreadsheet. Good job.
This is actually a really easy case for me to make.
You giving fantasy analysis that doesn't have anything to do with fly ball ratios or xFIPs or anything like that?
I'm going
to
be talking, although that's always a great benefit to anybody out there listening.
I fear what I do not understand, and I don't understand how that's possible.
The guy's been terrible for 2 years now.
Correct pronunciation is Blackburn.
I don't know. I feel like you have this delusional conception.
I'm going to disagree.
Maybe I'm just stupid or I've never understood.
I don't understand why you would even make that comparison.
I did learn something.
I really don't get it.
I've had some other, you know, wacky picks, some good, some bad.
Pumping gas is your next move.
You know, the best years of their lives were spent calculating how they could pretend to buy someone for a dollar. You know, it's just, they turn into cartoons of themselves.
I sold my soul.
They're all going straight to hell, and so are you.
All right, welcome to the Fantasy Baseball Roundtable Show. I'm your host, Pat DiCaprio of FantasyPros911.com, joined tonight by Mike Podhorzer, Autographs, and an old friend, former co-host, one-time great man among baseball giants, and that would be the hot librarian, Gabriel Lundin. Gabriel, welcome back. What have you been up to in your year or so off of the Roundtable Show?
A little too much, Patrick. A little too much, maybe not enough, but I'm back, I've made it, and I'm here. And I'm here to wage war against the foe that is Mike Podhorzer.
Bringing back the old Roundtable Show when you and Mike were on different sides of every issue. Good times, they were good times. It's so good to have you back, Gabriel. I'm looking forward to maybe you and Mike getting into a little bit of verbal fisticuffs tonight. Mike, you primed and ready to go here to take on Gabriel like old days?
That's the only reason I came on tonight. I was actually looking forward to a night off, but then you're like, show on tonight, Gabe's back, and I'm like, damn, I am on.
Awesome. Well, let me, I'm trying to think of which topic we should start out with, something that both you guys will disagree on. So it's going to be something a little bit stat heavy, maybe. Let me ask you guys about a guy that I think is going to be a...
Pat, just want to stop you for a second because the audio is sounding retarded every so often, so I don't know what's going on.
I think that's just your voice talking.
Yes, that could very well be.
I think that's definitely it. All right. Well, let's talk about two guys who really busted out in a huge way this year, one of whom we've mentioned before, who I had the great displeasure of trading for Adam Dunn in the FantasyPros911.com Expert League, thereby resigning myself to fifth place when I had a legitimate chance to win again. And that is Jacoby Ellsbury and another guy that's broken out in the power department, Howie Kendrick. Essentially, we'll talk about these guys one at a time, but really, I want to know if you guys think the power spikes that these two guys have shown is for real. So, Gabriel, let me start out with you. Let's start out with Jacoby Ellsbury. Do you think that is a real power spike we've seen from Jacoby Ellsbury, or is it something, a fluke that's not going to repeat itself?
I think it's real enough that you have to take it seriously, but nobody would have guessed he'd hit this many homers. I mean, he's definitely got some pop. He's not Juan Pierre, and he plays in a park that is super conducive to a little extra power. If you put Ellsbury in Petco, I don't think it's real. Leave him in Boston, I think it's real enough that – is he the new Carl Crawford?
He might be. He this year probably better than what Crawford has done in his career.
Oh, absolutely. This year, Crawford, I mean, forget about it.
No, I mean, his year this year may be better than any year that Crawford's had.
Gotcha, yeah.
Context, given the offensive downturn that we've seen this year. So you think it's somewhat repeatable? You think there's a reasonable chance he might, let's say, 17 to 20 home runs next year? You think that's a reasonable bet?
I would set the over-under at 15 and probably take the under, but not that far under. 14 to 17 sounds more realistic to me, but that now we're just picking hairs here.
All right. Mike, let me ask you about Ellsbury, and you knowing me and having done the show for a long time, you know what I'm going to mention. That is a 16.2% home run per fly ball rate, coupled with a 33% fly ball rate. It's not possible for a guy to do that again and hit 20 home runs, is it?
No, absolutely not. I don't think anybody expects a repeat, another near 30 home run season. But that's not the question. I think really the question is he now Carl Crawford where you could expect 15 to 20 home runs rather than 10 that he had been giving previously? And, you know, he actually has only stolen 37 bases this year. And yeah, I don't own Ellsbury, so I didn't even realize he basically stopped stealing bases. So in terms of overall fantasy value, I'm not even sure this has increased his fantasy value because he just traded steals for home runs, and usually steals, one steal is worth more than one home run. So I don't know from a fantasy perspective. But I'm looking at Hit Tracker Online, which is a great site, which actually measures the exact distance of a hitter's home runs and the average speed off of his bat. And usually you like to see home runs hit further when a player has a power spike. And surprisingly, he's only hit like five just enough home runs, which means only five home runs have just barely cleared the wall. Every other has been categorized as a no doubter or plenty, which suggests that he hasn't been lucky. He's not hitting the ball any further really than in the past or any faster off of the bat. So, I mean, it's really difficult here. I mean, he's at a good age, of course. But I can't imagine him repeating. It's just a matter of, is he going to hit 20 again? And
oh, go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
Yeah, I think he is establishing a somewhat new skill level, and I would guess that I'm going to project next year around 17 home runs or so.
Gabriel, are you drafting Jacoby Ellsbury in the first round next year?
I'm having a very hard time doing that, but then again, the first round is in such flux right now. I feel like half the first rounders, without even looking at the first round, it's going to look very different in 2012. You can make the case, but let's say I have the 10 pick, Patrick. I'll take Joey Votto there over Jacoby Ellsbury.
But Votto's not going to be there at 10, I don't think. I mean, it would be.
I mean, it's entirely possible. I don't want to do a mock draft on here. But I guess what I'm saying is, I would go for a safer power hitter, knowing that power seems to be a more scarce commodity in baseball right now. Period. And figure I can get speed that Ellsbury would offer me elsewhere while taking the power uptick.
You know, I think that's a reasonable way to approach it. Let me ask you about Mark Teixeira. Would you draft him over Jacoby Ellsbury?
I don't think I would because I'm not liking Teixeira's batting average. I just don't like the guy's attitude. I know attitude's not a stat, but I feel like he doesn't want it enough. I need my first rounders to want it. I feel like Teixeira is like four cheeseburgers away from Adam Dunn 2011.
Oh, God, I hope not as a Yankee fan. Hey, Mike, let's move over to Howie Kendrick. You guys are both somewhat optimistic on Ellsbury. I'm going to be somewhat less optimistic only because I've had my share in the last couple of years of guys breaking out and me going all in on them, and then they just don't repeat that unprecedented skill spike, and there's just too much risk of that happening again here with Ellsbury. Howie Kendrick.
There's one more. I wanted to just note one more thing with Ellsbury that I just noticed. He's hit 45 doubles this year. In 2009, his previous full season, he hit only 27. The year before that, only 22. So he's not just seeing a home run spike. This is a huge power explosion, which kind of validates for me this home run spike. Maybe it is more legit than you would assume on the surface, because those 45 doubles means that he's just really...
Oh, yeah, well, look at his isolated slugging. He quadrupled it, basically.
Well, you could throw last year out. It was only 78 at-bats, but he's doubled it from his previous two full seasons.
So are you guys worried about a .336 batting average on balls in play? I mean, I know when a guy's having a good season, it's going to be higher, but is that inordinately high enough where you think that's an anomaly and it's going to come down?
No. That's right, just above his career average. His career average is .325, so that's barely above it. He's hitting line drives at a 23% clip. He's got speed, obviously got good power now, so .336 is absolutely reasonable. I would not expect a significant drop there.
Yeah, I agree with Mike there. The old rule generally is you take the line drive percentage and add 0.12 to it, and that's what you're going to have an expected batting average on balls in play. That as a rough guy shows you that his batting average on balls in play is not high. And then you throw in, of course, as Mike said, the speed. Speedy guys always out hit their batting average, their expected batting average on balls in play. So yeah, that's absolutely repeatable. Let's go over to Harry Kendrick, Mike, because I think even though I am not as optimistic as you guys are on Jacoby Ellsbury, I'm even less optimistic on Howie Kendrick. Do you think that that is a reasonable position here?
Yeah, I would agree. I'm actually shocked to see that his home run per fly ball ratio is 17.8%. His problem has always been that he's been an extreme ground ball hitter. He hits fly balls at less than a 30% rate, which is basically Juan Pierre, Ichiro, Derek Jeter territory. And none of these guys are 20 home run hitters. I mean, Jeter's hit 20 home runs maybe once or twice, but the other guy's obviously not. And it's extremely difficult to maintain a home run pace like that when you're hitting such so few fly balls. So he hits too many ground balls, and I mean, he's never shown anywhere close to this ability in terms of home run per fly ball ratio. So his ISO has jumped a bit, but it's not that much higher than 2009. So I think this is more of just home runs are going out instead of doubles, and I don't see this as legit as Ellsbury.
All right, let me go over to Gabriel. But, Mike, maybe while we're talking to Gabriel, you could check Hit Tracker online and see if there's any
strong
edits like there is for Ellsbury. Gabriel, what about you? Do you think Howie Kendrick can repeat this? Are we looking at a mid-career or hitting your peak power spike, or is this an absolute fluke?
I think the reason it's a fluke is, I guess I've always thought of Howie Kendrick as a contact hitter. He's not known as a power guy.
Wow.
And because he doesn't play in a lineup, you know, the Angels aren't known for taking walks. Socha wants those guys to swing, get on base. I feel like one fluke, one anomaly that could occur for next year leads to, you know, a not that impressive. Right now he's hitting 290. I thought this guy was supposed to win batting titles, Patrick. I'm not worried about his home runs. His home runs are just a bonus. And since, as Mike said, that there is some, you know, the advanced stats suggest something of a possible anomaly, I'm not that optimistic. I mean, I think he's a nice player, but I don't think he belongs in the discussion with Ellsbury. I don't think he's even a top five second baseman next year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, just let me go on with Kendrick here. I mean, obviously, if Kendrick is a top five second baseman, I think it's only because other guys will flop. And Gabriel, our old opening on the show, you had one of my quotes was, someone needs to explain to me why Howie Kendrick is considered a threat to the batting title or something like that. There's absolutely no chance of a guy with his skill profile, I think, ever winning a batting title, even challenging for one. You can't walk as seldom as he does and challenge for a batting title. It's very, very difficult to do. Especially when you're pounding the ball on the ground as opposed to hitting line drives like he is. All right, Mike, what do you got for us?
So here's our answer. Howie Kendrick leads the Angels by far in just enough home runs. 13 of his 18 home runs are the just enough variety. That ties him for second place in all of the American League. And usually it's not enough to just look at the total number of just enoughs, because obviously the more home runs you hit, the more opportunity for just enough. So if you hit 60 home runs, you're likely leading the league in just enoughs as well. But he only has 18 home runs, and 13 of them means 72% of his home runs are of the just enough variety. And on average, 27% of a hitter's home runs are just enough. He's at 72%. So this is the flukiest of the fluke. And next year, I mean, he's back down to 10 again, I think.
Well, I guess one could say that if this year's a fluke, that means next year he's going to flounder. Would that be right?
maybe tilapia will join the party. I actually had that for dinner tonight, and
yeah,
this is segueing into a fantastic conversation
that's
about
right.
fish.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
No, but guys, I think you missed the most obvious one with Mike Trout batting in that
You're scaling that humor there, Gabriel.
How about bringing Tim Salmon back from retirement?
They should trade for Mike Clark.
How come the Angels always find themselves involved with fish?
I don't know. It must be that Los Angeles thing. Although I guess with Los Angeles, it would be fish covered in sewage or smog or something. All right. Well, let's move on from those two guys. I think the general consensus here is Ellsbury may be able to repeat it. Kendrick, no chance on earth that he's going to repeat it. So if you're out there and you write it down, I wrote an article about this basically that you should actually, and I do this, I'll be glad to send my notes to anybody who emails me, But you got to keep written notes of all the stuff and all the skills changes and all the playing time and all that stuff that happens in September, because you're going to forget it before April. Write it down now, keep it hidden on your computer, and then you will remember it. And this is a Howie Kendrick is some great, great stuff to write down, because that 13 just enough home runs, nobody's going to know that, and he's going to be overvalued in every draft unless you're a listener of the Roundtable Show. All right, let's look at another guy who now we're going to move over to a pitcher, and this is a guy I think is the opposite of these two guys, where you're going to have huge, huge hidden value in this guy next year. At least I do. A lot of other people aren't as psyched about him as I am, and that is Brandon Morrow. So, Gabriel, I'm going to ask you about Brandon Morrow. Is he a big fantasy baseball sleeper for next year?
I think he's a sleeper precisely because he's not had a great year this year. This is almost what you want if you're looking for Brandon Morrow. We know he's got the strikeout talent, but we also know he's very erratic with control. He has a bit of an injury history, and he doesn't play in the world's greatest not home run ballpark in Toronto. So I think he's a sleeper, but I'm not jumping for him. This seems like the very definition of high risk, high reward, and those guys have more value in proportion to where you drafted them. So yes, I like Brandon Morrow, but why do I feel like a guy with a 5 ERA, even if he has almost 200 strikeouts this year, 187, he's still, you're going to pay the price for those strikeouts. This is not, I don't think you're picking up an ace here. You're picking up a supplement to your pitching staff. He's your number 5 guy who maybe you don't start all the time.
All right. What about you, Mike? What do you think here about Brandon Morrow? Is Gabriel right that he's a number 5 and not a guy you should reach for?
Well, sure. He's a number 5 if he's posting an ERA like this year. But Morrow is a funny guy because he's a guy for Rotographs, I've covered AL starting pitchers all year, and I'm one of the most stubborn authors on the site in terms of changing my rankings, because I don't really budge that much based on I pretty much ignore ERA. I look at the skills, and Brandon Morrow is one of those guys. Edwin Jackson was another guy, but he moved to the NL, thank God. And Morrow was one of those guys who I had stubbornly kept in like the third tier every single month, despite a terrible ERA. I kept on talking about the skills and the bad luck, and all the commenters attacked me and killed me and said he's just not good. Stop looking at the stats, watch him pitch, blah, 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 you know, the same stuff, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I've heard it all about Morrow. But there are a lot of things that are very intriguing about Morrow this year. The strand rate is basically what's killing him. He's never shown an inability to strand runners. This is the first year, so we can't say this happens to him every year. His batting average on balls in play, right around league average. That's not a problem. Last year, it was very inflated, so you can't say he has a problem with that. Home run per fly ball ratio, pretty normal, right around league average. He's fine with that. That strand rate is what's killing him, but he's really improved his control this year. And to back that up, his first strike percentage, which is what I usually use to validate a walk rate, is above 60%, which is a huge bump from last year. So the walk rate improvement is shit. And if he can maintain that next year, there is just absolutely no way that you could have a 3-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio, including striking out 10 batters per 9, and not have an ERA under 4. It just doesn't happen more than one year in a row. It's going
to
be something where you look back.
You're gonna
look back last year, and you're gonna say, "Oh, of course his ERA is below 4. Look at his underlying peripherals. Stupid me for focusing too much on the ERA." That I can guarantee, because this happens so many times. You get scared off by the ERA. You come up with all these reasons to justify why the ERA is real and the ERA estimator is not, and then you realize that you shouldn't have done it, and you kick yourself. And I can guarantee that this is what's going to happen with Morrow.
Yeah, you know, Gabriel, I heard the horrible, horrible comparison to Oliver Perez there. So why don't you elucidate
on that? I'm sure it's not apropos. I'm not sitting there looking at you know, his what when he wears boxers on the road and night games or anything. But I wonder.
258 ERA when he's wearing boxers on the road, Gabriel. Anybody knows that.
What about the briefs, Patrick?
Boxer briefs? How do you deal with the fact that he's wearing a hybrid? How does that work?
Well, I'll tell you what you should deal with is apparently he's got a new cut fastball that helped him throw eight shutout innings against your Yankees there, Mr. DiCaprio. So maybe Morrow is for real. I'm not saying he's not for real. I'm just saying that it's a very high risk pick, and I wouldn't be too upset if I didn't miss out on him. I think there's a lot of pitchers out there.
All right, let me say this. I think that Brandon Morrow will be a top 20 pitcher overall next year. I know it's going out on a limb. I know this isn't our Are You Crazy time, but there's some awesome, awesome things to like about Brandon Morrow. Mike hit on some of them, but let me just go to one more, and that is the Baseball HQ base performance value, which basically is a measure of, in one number, an attempt to measure the overall skill of a pitcher. 100 is awesome for a starting pitcher. In fact, there are only 5 starters who have recorded over a 100 basic pitching value in 2010-2011. That's Justin Verlander, Felix Hernandez, Dan Haran, James Shields, and one Brandon Morrow. The other interesting thing is Morrow is in exactly the same position that Shields was last year. Shields had an ERA over 5 with an expected ERA, again using the Baseball HQ numbers, 2 runs lower. That's almost exactly where we are with Brandon Morrow here. That's almost exactly where we were with Eubaldo Jimenez 2 years ago. We're all touting him. We had the same type of skills growth with Eubaldo Jimenez, with the improving control as we have seen here with Brandon Morrow. I have, not only do I think he's going to do that, I think he's a relatively safe bet to do that. I am going all in on Brandon Morrow next year. Am I crazy,
yeah,
Gabriel?
Is the thing that's great about Morrow is that his strikeouts provide a value floor. He's not like a 6 strikeout per guy per inning, per 9 guy, where he really needs to, you know, get his luck back on track to provide value. Even if he remains a little bit unlucky, at least he's providing you with strikeouts.
All right, Gabriel, did you have something to say about this?
I was just going to say that no, I don't think you're crazy. My opinion of Brandon Morrow is probably colored by getting burned by him in head-to-head. So I have only memories of bad starts. Brandon Morrow has only done bad things to me this year for some reason, and I'm a little burned. I'm a little hurt. I've cried the tears, and you know I'm working through it. I'm working through it.
Well, we'll need to have some. There's a guy in here in New York named Steve Summers who does rehab for certain teams when they're doing horrible. He used to have Jets rehab and Mets rehab. Maybe we need to have Gabriel do Brandon Morrow rehab. That might be a good thing for you. We'll tell you some great things about Brandon Morrow. We'll play some nice music in the background, and you'll feel better about him, and you'll be willing to draft him as a top 30 pitcher next year. You think that'll work?
I feel better already.
Good.
Top 5.
I'm glad to hear it.
Jared Weaver, not so much. Brandon Morrow, sign me up.
Yeah, you know, I took some flack for this on Twitter about 2 months ago. I said expect a big regression from Jared Weaver because his home run per fly ball rate at the time was about 2%. And, oh, you're nuts, you're crazy, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, he's been a lot worse. You know, this regression is a very, very powerful tool. And that's where I know Mike will agree, maybe you less so, Gabriel, but that's how you find these huge values. And Brandon Morrow fits right in that. He is going to be a huge value next year, and I am, as long as he stays healthy, I feel relatively certain that he's going to do it. All right, let's take a short break here. We'll come back, and we'll talk a little more baseball with prodigal son Gabriel Lundin and Mike Podhorzer here on the Fantasy Baseball Roundtable Show. All right, welcome back to the Fantasy Baseball Roundtable Show. This is Pat DiCaprio, joined by Gabriel Lundin and Mike Podhorzer. And, guys, let's talk about a little closers. This is another thing that every year it's people want to know the closers. It's always tough to handle. Lots of situations in flux, especially this year. So two guys that have surged a little bit in September I wanted to address, Jason Mott and Jim Johnson. Let's talk about Jim Johnson first, and Mike, I'll start off with you. Is Jim Johnson a guy that you think is capable of holding the job next year? Is he going to be option number one, and can he do it? Or is he a guy that's just going to be fool's gold for people trolling for saves?
You know, what's amazing to me about Jim Johnson is a guy throws 95 miles an hour, and yet his career strikeout rate is 5.8 per 9 innings.
Well,
how is that even possible?
He hasn't thrown 95, though, to be fair. He started out in, I think, around 90 or so and has increased his average fastball velocity every year. I think he's been in the majors, roughly.
Yeah, you are correct. Well, this is quite a graph from – he debuted in 2006 at 88.6, and now he's throwing 95.1. That's pretty insane. But the last 3 years, he's thrown at least 94 miles an hour, and his high strikeout rate was only 7.5. So it's quite surprising. You would think that he'd be striking out more batters. His swinging strike percentage suggests a higher strikeout rate. Throws a ton of first strikes, so he has good control, and he's a major ground ball pitcher. This looks like a fantastic reliever. So, yeah, I think he can keep the job.
Well, let me ask you one thing. I mean, basically, Johnson's become essentially a one-pitcher, two-pitch pitcher. And unless you have a lot of good
– He throws three pitches.
Yeah, but one of them is throws like, you know, 2% of the time. It isn't very good.
Curveball, 10%. Changeup, 17%. Fastball, 73%. You know, that's reasonable for a reliever.
What's the value of his changeup?
Insane this year. 3.5. Last year, 3.1. The year before, 3.6.
All right.
Curve hasn't been very good.
Yeah, the curve is what I meant. I know the curve was below average because I just wrote about this at USA Today.
Yeah, the curve has had negative run values.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he can't have, I mean, if all three pitchers were so good, he'd probably be a starter. So.
Yeah, well, he would. He's a failed starter. You know, I just wonder, like, guys like this, big fastball, but maybe not a lot of movement and not a good setup pitch with the curveball. I mean, the changeup's okay, but, you know.
Yeah, but, I mean, his swinging strike percentage is above the league average. To me, just being very familiar with the stat and how it matches up with strikeout rates, it's telling me his strikeout rate should be above 7. Is that great for a reliever? No. But combine that with very good control and a fantastic ground ball rate, and this is a really good reliever.
So if you were better, you'd be willing to draft him next year as a closer? Let's assume that Show.
Absolutely. He's a guy I would target who has no name value. He's going to be in the bottom tier of closers, really basically getting his first shot at a full-time closing opportunity, but has the skill set to keep the job. This is the type of guy that I like drafting.
All right, Gabriel, how about you? Are you sold on Jim Johnson?
You know, I'm sold on Jim Johnson in the sense that everything Mike said and the role, that if Davey Johnson gets a role, I'm gonna draft him. I'm not entirely sold yet because I don't think Buck Showalter is sold. If Buck Showalter was so sold, I know these managers play a certain mind game with the closers, but why hasn't he declared him the closer, Patrick? Why is there talk that I'm reading of him possibly starting? Why are we having this undefined role? It's not like he's out there, you know, fire-breathing dragon killing the Orioles pen. I think he's a guy occupying a role, a talented reliever who will certainly be in the mix, but I mean, if he has the role, you're gonna draft anybody. That's not really a question or a tidbit that we need to let the fans in on here. But I think you have to watch the role. Right now, of course, you'll take anything if you're trying to win a league. But I don't think he's any guarantee. I'm not penciling him into the closer position for 2012.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I think there's some merit to that. Obviously, Johnson has, I think, the basic skills to be a reasonably good closer. But he also has, despite the fact that his curveball is below average, he can at least throw three pitches. He has been a starter in the past. His fastball velocity is up, and the team has not developed a starter since God knows when. It'd just be so tempting for them to say, hey, let's give Johnson another shot. We basically have nothing else to shoot for. And that could be one of the major negatives here with Johnson. But skills-wise, absolutely he has the ability to be a very good closer. And if he is announced as having the job and stays in the pen, I think he's a very, very good draft pick, as Mike said. All right, what about Jason Mott, Gabriel? This is a guy, man, forever people thought you maybe had naked pictures of Tony La Russa's daughter or God knows what, but he was in the doghouse forever. And people have been saying, free Jason Mott, give him a chance. And he finally gets a chance after five other guys fail. And it seems like he's doing a pretty good job. What do you think, Gabriel? Is Jason Mott going to be a reasonably good closer selection next year?
I think Jason Mott has a better chance of keeping a closer job than Jim Johnson. I like the stuff better. I like, even with the Tony La Russa thing, we never know how he uses his bullpen. We don't know what happened between family members, but I do think that he's got better skills. And with closers, if you go for the skills rather than the role, Mott's your guy. But again, the Cardinals, that's an even bigger flux. That's a whole other question right there. I go with Mott over Johnson.
All right. How about you, Mike? What do you think here? Mott over Johnson?
Oh, my God. If only Tony La Russa wasn't part of the equation.
Yeah, I know.
Mott.
Well, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Yeah, I've drafted Mott before as closer and got nowhere. He blows one save and he's out of the role. I remember earlier this year, La Russa comments, oh, Mott isn't ready. What? And now suddenly he's ready? Within half a season, he's ready and he's performing successfully in a role? I mean, Tony La Russa is out of his mind. He doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know what he wants or it makes absolutely no sense. Of course he's successful because he's a good relief pitcher, and a good relief pitcher is going to be able to close, period. So, I mean, Lourdes is still scared of me.
I do know, you know as well as I do, that there's so much pressure on the closer that there's that intestinal fortitude matters a lot more than their actual skills. Don't you? You have to agree with that, don't you?
Yes, of course. How could I not? Until
being sarcastic,
I see, yeah. Until I see a sample size of more than 10 innings of a guy who doesn't have the intestinal fortitude, then I'm not going to believe any of that gibberish. Look at Ryan Madsen. I thought he didn't have it. Then suddenly he developed it when Brad Leach and Jose Contreras went down. So, anyway, yeah, I'm afraid of Mott. If he blows two saves in a row, he's out of the job. Would I agree that he's a better bet in terms of pure skills and performance than Jim Johnson and a more prototypical closer? Yes, but his manager is crazier.
Yeah, no, I got to say, I actually am going to go on a little bit of a limb here and say that I like Johnson a little bit better for next year than Mott. And the only reason, there's a couple of reasons. The first is this La Russa factor where it's a complete crapshoot, and we've seen how that goes. But Mott has also been very lucky this year almost across the board. Last time I checked, he had a 2% home run per fly ball rate. It's still right around in that ballpark. His expected ERA was more than a run and a half higher than his actual ERA. And he's had a below-average batting average balls in play and way above-average left-on-base percentage. So, and forget about the fact also that he's faltered a little bit, as we've already seen that those numbers start to regress a little bit. The combination of the possibility of regressing next year and the complete wild card that's La Russa, I don't know, I see Mott maybe coughing the job up and never getting it back again, and Johnson being worth more next year than Mott. Gabriel, what do you think about that theory?
I think that's a perfectly valid theory, but a lot of what you guys are saying is really, really fancy talk about nothing. Because what has baseball taught us? Closers, very few closers get to keep their role. We've had more volatility than ever, and I'm just not ready to trust anybody.
Yeah, you know, that's certainly true. And Baseball HQ keeps a chart of that every year about how many closers lose their job, and it's usually more than half. But that's why we always say draft skills, not roles. And
sure.
But here, the skill set of Mott looks better on the surface, but the regression that I would expect off of his skill set, to me, makes him look a little bit less palatable than Jim Johnson. What do you say, Mike?
I definitely agree with all the regression on Mott, and that regression is going to be even worse, doubly worse, being that he plays for Tony La Russa, because if that regression happens in a week and suddenly he allows two home runs in the week over, you know, two or three innings, I mean, that can get La Russa upset and start throwing darts at his picture. And the thing is that they have a lot of good bullpen arms. I mean, Mitchell Boggs is still there. He's shown good skills. I mean, he already tried out. Fernando Salas is still there. Eduardo Sanchez, I think, didn't he have, like, shoulder problems or something?
Yes.
But whatever. He came up. He showed great skills. He's a young guy. They have all these potentially good bullpen arms that could steal the job away, who could be capable of holding on to a job. So I think Mott has a lot of competition and a manager that is willing to make the switch after one bad week.
Well, Mike, you know what? I think your best hope is that Mott gets traded to the Marlins, because apparently Leo Nunez has been playing under an assumed name and is heading back to the Dominican Republic.
Is that it?
That's true. There could be a vacancy. Apparently Leo Nunez is not Leo Nunez. Is Jason Mott Jason Mott? Only Tony La Russa knows.
Yeah, that is too funny.
His real name is Juan Carlos Oviedo. He's actually a year older than his listed age of 29.
The funny part is, how has he gotten this far with the wrong? I mean, we've seen this happen before, but not for this long, not for a guy of this, stature. I mean, this is shocking that this happens.
It's pretty funny.
It is pretty amazing. It does make you wonder what would have happened if he had gotten traded at the deadline, and let's say the Red Sox picked as a middle reliever. What happens then? This could have been a huge scandal. Now that it's Florida, nobody cares. But
Okay. So while on RotoWorld, I'm scrolling down and see an update on none other than our man Jason Mott. Jason Mott walked three of the five batters he faced after coming into a 6-2 game against the Mets, and the Cards went on to lose 8-6. Mott didn't take a blown save with a loss, but he was charged with four runs, three of them earned. And this is his fourth straight shaky appearance, which probably means that La Russa is going to make the switch, and Mott might not even last the rest of the year as the closer. So he's basically already lost his job, and next year hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, you know, hey, like I said before, regression is a very powerful force, probably the most powerful force in fantasy baseball, and you ignore it at your peril. And this is, I guess, a good example. All right, let's move on to a player of a little bit more recent vintage, a little younger guy, but a huge prospect, probably the number one pitching prospect in the entire minor leagues, and that is Matt Moore, getting called up by the Tampa Bay Rays, who, for some reason, they develop pitchers like they're growing out of the ground, as opposed to the Orioles, who every single good pitching prospect they have turns an absolutely horrible season after horrible season after horrible season. Are you excited about this guy next year, Gabriel? Is this a guy that you would consider drafting in a mixed league?
I think I would. Yeah, I'm absolutely excited about him. I mean, his pedigree is we know all about that. And he probably, you could argue that the Rays could have brought him up earlier. I mean, I'm sort of tired of the argument of the Rays blew it this year because they were doing what they thought was best in a realistic, low market atmosphere, figuring they were 8.5 back at the trade deadline. They didn't expect the Red Sox to choke this badly. So I don't blame them for not bringing him up. But I think he could be, why couldn't Matt Moore be Helixson next year? I see no reason why you wouldn't want to draft this guy, especially because he's going to fly under the radar in a lot of leagues.
Well, he looks a lot better than Helixson to me, if only because Helixson, I think, is due for a big-time regression next year. I have the unfortunate distinction, though, of having a bet on Wade Davis versus Jeremy Helixson this year on our Fantasy Baseball Roundtable Show website on our board bets. But I will say this, I'm willing to double down that bet next year because I think Davis might actually outperform Helixson again next year. So if I think that, I certainly think Matt Moore might. Mike Potterzo, how about you? Are you a big Matt Moore fan? You think he's going to be a mixed league worthy draftee?
You know, I have to admit that coming into the year, until I started reading about him mid-season when they were talking about a call-up and top prospects, I never even heard of this guy. I don't know where he came from. I've usually heard of top prospects, every top prospect, and I never heard of this guy. So from a scouting perspective, I have nothing really to add, although he's been averaging 96.5 miles an hour with his fastball in a relief role, which I assume will translate
well, you
as
saw,
a starter.
I don't know if you saw how well he pitched tonight against a somewhat depleted Yankees offense. They're starting Andrew Jones and Montero and Brandon Laird and Greg Golson, et cetera, et cetera. So they got a Triple-A lineup out there. But 5 innings pitched, 4 hits, 1 walk, 11 Ks against the Yankees.
Wow.
Tonight.
So, wait, did he start?
Yes, he did. They said they announced he was going to start. They brought over the pitch and relief, but they need him to start this game.
Okay, so I was gonna make a guess at what his velocity is going to be as a starter. I would have said 93, 94 is what he'll average as a starter. Was he throwing around? You think just watching the game, is that what he was averaging around?
You know, I'm looking. I'm only watching the game on my Major League Baseball game day, which actually is I actually enjoy it a little bit more than actually watching the game. For one thing, in New York, you have horrible announcers, especially if you're on the radio. You get Susan Waldman, who gives me shivers every time she talks. But number two, you get so much more data on it. Yeah, but he has been throwing in the mid-90s during the game when he was in. He's no longer in.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Your question is yes.
It looks like he'll have occasional control problems, and I'd like to see more ground balls, but you can't ignore 79 strikeouts in 52 and two-thirds innings in AAA. So anybody with that strikeout potential, at every single level that he has been, his lowest strikeout rate was 11.5, which is pretty damn amazing.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, why are you concerned about his control? I don't know. He looks to me like he has pretty decent control. 3.1 walk rate in AAA this year, 2.5 in AA.
Which translated to Major League Baseball would be closer to league average right now is 3.1. Probably around, I would say, 3.3, 3.4.
Yeah, that's not too bad. I mean, for a starting
pitcher, it's not too bad. You're right. It's not bad. But
you know,
in the past, he struggled every so often in different levels with his control. So it could be something that, you know, he'll have a start where he'll walk 4 or 5 batters. And of course, any rookie pitcher is going to have occasional bouts with control problems. But it looks like he's definitely somebody that will. But other than that, I mean, you have to keep on your radar somebody with that type of strikeout potential. And a lefty throwing, you know, 95 miles an hour, I mean, you can't ignore that. So he's definitely somebody to consider even in mixed leagues, even though he's going to be a rookie.
All right, Gabriel, did you have something to add there?
The only thing I wanted to add, and tell me if I'm nuts, guys, is it a hackneyed? Thank you. I knew that already. But is it a hackneyed comparison to think that Matt Moore could put up Tim Lincecum's rookie season? I mean, 146 innings, 150 Ks, not the greatest record, ERA right around 4. Is that crazy?
No, I don't think it is.
I think that would be maybe a slightly disappointing.
Yeah,
to be honest.
I was gonna say it might be a little bit disappointing.
Maybe.
But here's the thing, you know, first of all, Lincecum didn't have the time in the minors that he did. But also, I mean, look, I'm a guy that's usually very, very pessimistic about any rookie pitcher, no matter what the pedigree, no matter what the skills say. But I got to tell you, I'm making an exception to my rule on Moore, because I think he, to me, he looks like the next big thing. Obviously, we got to hope he gets past the injury nexus. But there's absolutely nothing to me that I see in his record that would give me pause or concern. He looks absolutely ready. He looks ready to come in next year and be a number two or a number three starter at worst. And again, this is coming from a guy who I poo-poo almost every single rookie pitcher that comes up because, well, rookie pitchers are the death of you. It's like the old Corey Schwartz saying, the road to fifth place is paved with closers of the future. It's also paved with rookie pitchers. And it's rare the time that I think it's worth deviating from that rule, but Matt Moore, I think, is one of those guys who makes it worth deviating from. All right, let's take another short break, and we'll come back with Gabriel Lundin doing his Are You Crazy, and then hopefully we'll have some good tee-off segments, and if we have time, maybe we'll throw in another topic or two. This is the Fantasy Baseball Roundtable Show here at FantasyPros911.com.
What you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
All right, Gabriel. Yeah, you're welcome back to the show. And, of course, we put you right on the hot seat for the Are You Crazy? So let us know what you got. What's your prediction this week?
A top three catcher in mixed leagues in 2012 will be J.P. Arencibia. Discuss.
Top three. Wow. So we got Brian McCann, Mr. Podhorseman. I'll throw it up to you first. Brian McCann, Victor Martinez, if he qualifies, and you know this, we do this completely off the top of our head, so I'm gonna have to look and see if he actually qualifies. Alex Avila, you know, you got some other guys there. I don't know, Mike. What do you think? Is Gabriel crazy? Top three catcher.
He's batting 220 this year. It just, if he were to be a top three catcher, I think he might be the lowest batting average ever for a catcher that earned top at the position. Wow. With 20% chance. Let's see if there's any chance that average increases. Extreme fly ball hitter. So the 254 BABIP is probably not going to increase that much. He's had a history of not that great batting average on balls and play in the past, but it'll probably increase a bit. Maybe he'll get that average up to 240 or so. Oh, man. Top three, 20%. I would say crazy because you're aiming a little too high. I think maybe fifth he has a 20% chance of getting to, but top three, I think it's lower than that. Not too far, though, because of that power. But I definitely think just because of that batting average and the fact that he doesn't walk very often and he's slow, so his runs are not going to be anything special. Obviously, he's not going to steal any bases. So, I mean, he's really just a two-category guy, which, of course, you're not going to get that much from catchers anyway. But I think that he has too many issues, too many strikeouts to be a top three guy.
Yeah, all right, Gabriel. I'm going to say that you are crazy also. Now, I will give you a chance to try and sway our votes, but going into next year, just in the American League, he's got to be better than Matt Wieters. He's got to be better than Carlos Santana. He's got to be better than Alex Avila. He's got to be better than Russell Martin. He's got to be better than Mike Napoli, who was really fantastic this year. And there's a good chance of him being better than a lot of those guys. And certainly, and I think this is the issue when you have this type of comparison. When you look at player X and you say he'll be better than this guy and better than this guy, well, sure, there's a good probability that Aaron Sibbia will be better than any one of those guys. But when you have to beat all of them, all of whom also have the chance of improving this year, it becomes very, very difficult for me to say that he's going to be better than a lot of those guys. And that's just in the AL. Forget about the NL, you got Brian McCann, and Ramon Hernandez was decent this year, and Miguel Montero, who hopefully will have a rebound. You know,
Montero has been great this year. He did rebound.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. But, you know, you still got to see it for a whole year, I think. You're still talking about a player with two good halves as opposed to Aaron Sibbia, who might hit 35 homers next year as a catcher. You know, I want to see him do it again for a whole year and not just, you know, half and half. But anyway, be that as may, we can argue about it. But the fact is, I think it's very difficult for Aaron Sibbia to do that, as Mike said, with the bad batting average. Any one of those guys, sure, you can have a great argument that he's better than any one of those guys, probably better than any two of those guys. But to make it into the top three, he's got to beat out a lot of other guys who are either more established, have better track records, or have even more upside than he does, like Carlos Santana. So I'm going to say you're crazy here, Gabriel, but I'm willing to be convinced, so let's hear your arguments.
I am willing to admit that top three was a bit of a reach, but I do think that there's hope for the batting average, and we know he's a free swinger. He did hit 300 in AAA, which, for what that's worth, I know it's a whole different situation. He played in the PCL, but I do think that the batting average will rise. I like that he plays in a great lineup, great ballpark. He's got the man in white stealing signs for him. You guys gotta like that, right? And I also like, and I know this isn't a fantasy category, and you guys can't, you know, measure this in a stat, and you're gonna kill me for it. I like that this year he's been sort of apprenticing under Jose Molina, who's a defensive catcher, which means that he's going to stay at catcher and he's going to get the at-bats that you want him to have. And just with the level of flux and attrition that we see at catcher, I'm simply not counting on all of those guys having a great year for any number of the reasons that you said. But if you ask me, do I want Russell Martin or J.P. Aaron Sibbia, that's absolutely nuts. I think that the reason I said top three is I wanted to highlight that I believe he's been very undervalued this year and will be undervalued going into next year. And while your league mates are going, oh my God, Mike Napoli, OMG, Aaron Sibbia is going to be Mike Napoli basically 8 to 10 rounds later.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about everything you said. And I think we even had an Are You Crazy earlier in the year where maybe it was Mike, maybe it was someone else who said J.P. Aaron Sibbia will lead all catchers in home runs. And that shows you that I think he was not
that sounds
crazy.
Familiar.
Yeah, and I think you were not crazy because I know I agreed that it was definitely possible. In fact, I think I even said it probably will happen. So we love Aaron Sibbia, but everything you said has merit and could potentially come true. But the fact is that even if all that happens, he's still probably not going to be a top three. Like Mike said, if you said top five, I would say you're not crazy. But the difference between top five...
See, that was why I didn't say top five. I thought top five was a little too realistic.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm saying, yeah, if you said top five, I would probably say you're not crazy. So I give you credit for that, for going to the right number when we're talking about the Are You Crazy, really pushing the envelope a little bit, as opposed to, you know, Jason Mastrodonato, who you're subbing for, would be like, Albert Pujols will hit at least 260 next year. Am I crazy? So good credit for that. But Gabriel, I hate to say that I am... unconvinced of your argument, and so you're going to have to get the dreaded dough. So does that bring back good memories for you, Gabriel, getting the dreaded dough?
I'm so used to it, you know. I kind of expected it. I almost went even crazier just to make sure I got it.
You know, you mentioned, by the way, Jose Molina, and Mike, you may have seen this article about catcher framing. Did you see that that article, Framing Pitches?
I think that was a Fangraphs article, and I saw the title. I did not read the article.
Yeah, it was really good stuff about framing pitches and how much value catchers can add. And they found, basically, in a nutshell, found that a catcher who can frame pitches is worth about a win. And Jose Molina actually was the best at because and the theory is that he's so quiet when he catches the ball, the head doesn't move, the arms don't move, and so it gives the umpire, you know, the impression that it was a perfect pitch, as opposed to a guy who's moving all around and moving his head, moving his hands, and it makes it seem like it wasn't what was expected. I know, I there's some merit to that. And Jose Molina, number one on that list by a pretty good margin. I don't know. I mean, it seems like that there may be some validity to that. That's the kind of thing that even real baseball fans probably did not know. I certainly did not know. And I consider, you know, us to be relatively on the cutting edge of stats. But this is the kind of thing, boy, that it can really push the envelope in terms of knowledge and how we view players. And if this type of thing becomes commonplace within the industry, kids like Aaron Sibbia, boy, you know, it could be even more difficult for him to get the playing time if people see the great value that Jose Molina has by being able to frame pitchers. I know, I just thought it was a really interesting article, and I would recommend it for anybody who's interested in anything more than just fantasy baseball. You want to just increase your knowledge of the game. It was probably a good article. I think it was at Baseball Prospectus also, Mike. I'm not sure. It was by I saw it tweeted by Fastballs, who's the guy at Fastballs. So you could
That's probably Mike. Is that Mike Fast? Yes. Mike Fast. Yeah.
So you can follow it there. And speaking of Twitter, by the way, you could follow me at PDiCaprioFP911. And Gabriel, you can follow you on Twitter too. What's your Twitter handle?
It is G Lundeen, GLUNDEEN.
Yes, and you'll occasionally find Gabriel talking about library science, which is a great topic that everybody wants to know about, Gabriel, but also some interesting things like baseball, and you and I frequently fighting about, you know, politics or economics or some other nonsense that isn't nearly as important as fantasy baseball. So worth following Gabriel. And Mike, someday you'll discover Twitter and see how great a thing it is.
The only Twitter accounts I have had have been to promote my businesses. The first one, of course, doesn't exist. And the second one, we've already talked about, Paolo Cal. I do have a Twitter account for that. I have a whopping 2 followers. Very excited. Yes. I had 3 at one point, and somebody left me.
Well, do you still...
But Mike, you've got to be used to that by now.
That's right. Hey, do you still own that that Twitter name of... What was it? Greasy Dwarf Lover or something like that? I don't know. Do you still have that one, Mike?
Yeah. I don't know how you found out about it. It was supposed to be a secret.
Yeah, well, it's not a secret. In fact, it's all over YouTube now. All right. Anyway, enough of this ridiculous nonsense. Let's go on to our tee-off segment.
Yeah. Let's do another Are You Crazy?
Yeah, fine. Let's do one. Mike will make $1 million with his pal locale business. Gabriel, is he crazy?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you are absolutely crazy. All right, anyway, Mike Podhorzer had trying to make a legitimate business out of being a pimp, so we give him credit for that, but we'll see how it works out, Mike. But I really, really, really do, from the bottom of my heart, wish you all the best. I hope you make $1 billion out of it.
Thank you.
You can fund my retirement.
Then we can buy Blog Talk Radio, and I can promise you we'll get podcasts for free.
Yeah, there you go. Awesome. All right, let's go on to our tee-off segment, and Mike, we'll start off with you. Here's your chance to tee off.
All right, so a couple of days ago, there was apparently an article posted on Fangraphs about our official position on UZR, and I didn't see the article, and apparently it was taken down because I think the comments were crazy and talking about grammar mistakes and writing ability distracting from the writing, and then there was a whole argument about whether, you know, bad grammar is acceptable as long as the numbers are okay. And you know, you had some commenters on one side and some on the other. And I have to be honest, when I see bad grammar in writing, especially analytical articles related to fantasy baseball or baseball, I think less of the author, less of the research. And my perception is that if he can't spell, if he makes grammar errors, then perception is – The research is poor, the studies are not well thought out, and the numbers are wrong. So I really think that grammar and spelling is extremely important in writing, and it gets across the point that you're an intelligent human being and you're somebody that I want to read because I can trust you to, you know, do the research well because you're smart and you know how to write proper English and get across your point in a clear and concise manner, something I have a problem doing vocally. But we're not talking about my radio ability. So I'm actually curious on what your guys' thoughts are. If grammar and spelling problems are an issue, or if you don't really care as long as the numbers and the research seem okay. Anyone?
I would say
Bueller?
Absolutely, because as interested as I am in research, it's hardly the only thing that matters, and I'm far more interested in good writing than good numbers.
Pat? Have we lost Pat? Gabe?
I don't know. I don't know where
he
went.
Can you hear me now? Hello?
There
we
he
can
is.
Hear
okay.
you. Where did you
I
go?
I don't know what happened there. Sorry.
Did you hear anything I said?
Yes, I did. I heard it all. In fact, I was talking. I don't know what happened. Okay. Probably a Skype issue. But here's the thing. I tend to give people a pass in fantasy baseball world on that because, look, the fact is what my standards are not the same as what everybody else's. I'm an older guy. I've been writing for 20 years. And, look, that's the internet writing is not the same as paper writing, and people don't have the same expectations for it. If it's terrible as opposed to a mistake here or there, that's a different story. But, typos and a couple mistakes here and there, I'm willing to give people at least a pass on. Hell, you even see that at Baseball Prospectus and Baseball HQ and the best sites in the world. I mean, ESPN, you'll see typos. So I have to give them somewhat of a pass. But anyway, Gabriel, let me give you your chance here to tee off.
Well, I am going to tee off on something only slightly fantasy related, but I'm going to bring it right back around, so don't worry. My new favorite player, I'm not sure if you guys have talked about this guy, is Mr. Tony Plush, Niger Morgan. And I'm teeing off on every boring athlete, every boring fantasy player, every person who's just blah, 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 toeing the line, sitting there with these corporate athletes who exhibit no personality, no humanity. I mean, I love the numbers and the analytical side of baseball as much as you guys do, even if I don't emphasize the numbers. But really, if there's so much more to it, and I love seeing an athlete who displays his personality and was out there harnessing his inner crazy person to be better. And I think that in your fantasy leagues, you should be doing the exact same thing. You need to go find your inner Tony Plush, because you're just sitting there plugging these numbers. Oh, let me check his BABIP. You know what? Have a little fun. What are you doing this for? Unless you're out there, even if you're out there trying to win, I don't know, NFBC or something, you're not making a living on this. No one cares if you won your fantasy league. No one cares if you're the champion of the universe in fantasy baseball. You do it to have fun. You do it to make friends and have a good time. And so I say, go find that Tony Plush. If you didn't find him this year, find him next year. And you know what? Be a little crazy. Take a risk.
You know, it's funny because, God, I don't understand how baseball got to be like this, because you look at the type of players that existed 50 years ago or 40 years ago. This type of craziness was commonplace. You just didn't hear about it. And players, I mean, some of the stories that you hear from the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, players were absolutely crazy, the stuff that they would do, getting guys to jump off roofs and taking the opposing pitcher fishing and getting him drunk so that he would miss a start. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. Now it's, oh, my God, the guy has some things on Twitter. He said, oh, we got to send him to the minors, or we got to, he threw tobacco on the field. You know, what about guys throwing pitches at guys five times in a row, or throwing bats at guys, or John Roseboro getting hit on the head. I mean, Joe Garagiola getting run over at first base by I forget who it was when he bunted, because, I mean, the guy just flat out laid him out because Garagiola said something. I mean, stuff like that, nowadays, be, oh my God, you got to suspend the guy 20 games, or it'd be crazy. But that stuff was commonplace, and I agree with you 100% there on this one, Gabriel. 100%. All right, I'm going to take my chance here to tee. All right, it should seem relatively self-evident that the advance of numbers and science should be a good thing for everything. I don't care what it is. Would someone say that, boy, it was a bad thing that stat geek Galileo took the magic and the mystery out of the astronomy and being the Earth at the center of the universe, or that, oh, it was too bad that all these scientists took the magic and the mystery out of medicine. We don't need to cure diseases. We just want to, there's just such a mystery and a magic to it that's valuable. That's the most asinine, stupid thing that I could possibly think of, and yet it's amazing that writers for major websites like Jason Whitlock of ESPN can get away with writing something like "Stat Geeks have ruined sports because they take the magic and the mystery out of it." Well, excuse me if you're not smart enough to figure out that, number one, these are advances that make our understanding of the sport better. Number two, if you don't want to know those things, then I think you are not a fan in the first place. And for anyone to say that quote-unquote stat geeks, whatever that may be, and that's that in of itself we could devote a whole show to, because that's like the the biggest canard and the biggest lie that there is in the industry. There's no such thing as a stat geek. We had stat geeks since in the 1900s when Henry Chadwick was inventing box scores. And you don't have idiots like Jason Whitlock saying, oh yeah, he took the magic and mystery out of the game by inventing RBI. This other nonsense. It's just another way for guys to either A, act like basically internet trolls and throw something out there for the purposes of creating controversy, or B, just revealing how incredibly stupid they really are. And I'm not sure if Jason Whitlock is trolling or if he's just stupid, but the fact is that he is absolutely wrong, and this isn't a matter of opinion, it's a matter of facts. That the increase of statistical knowledge in sports is a great thing. It's not a bad thing. And I'm sorry to say, Jason, that if you think that sports should still be like people who thought the earth was flat and the earth was at the center of the universe and that, you know, there was witchcraft that caused all these things, well, you do it. Just don't hold the rest of us back. All right, guys, that's it for the rest of the show. Gabriel, it was great to have you on again, and hopefully we'll be able to have you on a more regular basis. And, Mike, I'm glad you were able to find time in your busy schedule with Paolo Cal. Come and join us. Talk a little fantasy baseball. Anyway, we'll see you all next week. Take care.